We are looking at mobilizing resources to Dillingham at this time.
A quick-moving tundra fire burns outside of Dillingham. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the mother of one of the murdered Hoonah police officers responds to the guilty verdict against John Marvin.
It's never going to be a closure for me, no matter what, because I see it, I relive it in my head, what happened that night.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Fueled by strong winds and dry tundra, a fire is burning outside of Dillingham. The fire started Friday afternoon on the edge of the city and has quickly consumed more than 10 miles of open tundra. Now the Forestry Division's Fire Management Office in McGrath is coordinating response. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
At about 3 p.m. on Friday, a small remote control plane crashed in the tundra near the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham, sparking a small fire. Strong northwest winds quickly spread that fire along the dry, open tundra. The fire stretched several hundred yards in length as volunteer fire crews arrived on scene just minutes later. With rakes, shovels, and portable water packs, around 30 volunteer firefighters worked to stamp out the blaze along the lines closest to the hospital and nearby neighborhoods. But the opposite side of the fire quickly moved south and east with the winds towards the coast and away from town. It burned out of control, scorching several miles of open tundra within hours, and continued its southward path over the weekend. Tom Dean is the acting fire management officer for the Division of Forestry's Southwest District Office in McGrath, which has been monitoring reports of the fire since Friday.
The tundra fires are a quick-burning fuel. It's a grass component. They burn very, very quickly, and they're very susceptible to changes in humidity. So what you're seeing is this tundra fire, when the sun comes up, it dries that grass out fairly quickly and it runs with the wind. It'll actually get active with the wind.
A survey flight flown on Sunday reported that the fire had burned over 10 miles to the south along the coast. Dean says that if the winds continue to blow from the north and west, the fire should be contained by the coast and the Snake River and may burn itself out in an area away from town and with no known structures. But playing it safe, the state is preparing a response effort anyway.
We are looking at mobilizing resources to Dillingham at this time, being prepared in case the wind shifts, which sometimes the wind can do, this fire might start moving backwards towards town, which would, of course, would be a concern to us. There's also native lands, tribal lands out there that need to be protected as well. So we are taking this fire as seriously as we can.
Dean says he's coordinating with multiple agencies, including the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge, which could be in the path of the fire if it's not stopped by the Snake River. Right now, the plan is just to survey and monitor the fire, but helicopters could be used to dump water if necessary. November is late in the fire season, and Dean says most of the state's firefighting resources are now off contract for the year, so whatever the response is, it'll probably take longer than usual to coordinate. One possible bit of good news is the high-pressure system over the Bering Sea, which is expected to continue generating strong north winds for the rest of the week. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
John Marvin Jr. will spend the rest of his life in prison for killing two police officers in Hoonah. A Juneau jury returned guilty verdict Saturday. The sentence will be no less than 119 years once it's handed down in February. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
John Marvin Jr. was accused of shooting Sergeant Anthony Wallace and Officer Matthew Tokaoka in Hoonah on August 28, 2010. Wallace was on duty with his visiting mother Debbie Green on a ride-along. Matthew Tokaoka was off duty with his wife Haley and their two children, socializing with Wallace and Green on Front Street, the main road through Hoonah. Prosecutors allege that Marvin shot at both officers in front of their families from the second floor of his house across the street. They believe that Marvin targeted the officers as retaliation for being tasered and arrested a year earlier, while the defense noted that no one really saw Marvin shoot the officers. He was only assumed to be the shooter after the earlier confrontation. Marvin later emerged from his house over a day after the shooting, surrendering to officers who had converged on Huna during the incident. A jury of 10 men and 2 women reached a verdict at about noon Saturday after 11 hours of deliberations that started on Friday. The 12-day trial started October 22nd in Juneau Superior Court, with Sitka Superior Court Judge David George presiding over the case. He read the verdicts Saturday afternoon.
As to count one, which is the allegation of murder in the first degree as to Anthony Wallace, the jury responds as follows. We, the jury, find defendant John Marvin Jr. guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in count one.
Wallace's mother, Debbie Green, and Tokaoka's widow, Haley Tokaoka, cried and embraced each other as the verdicts were read.
With regard to count two, the jury returned a verdict as follows. We, the jury, find the defendant John Marvin Jr. guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in count two. Dated this third day of November.
In the end, the jury returned with findings that Wallace was in uniform and on duty as a Huna police officer at the time of the shooting, and that will mean a 99-year sentence. But Tokaoka was off duty. The sentence for a conviction on that charge will be 20 to 99 years. Sentencing is planned for February 1st. Public defender Eric Hedlund was not immediately available for comment after the trial. District Attorney Dave Brower characterized himself only as the attorney at trial. He said he could not have prosecuted the case all by himself.
It was probably the most complicated case I've dealt with, and I had a lot of help, both in my office, law enforcement, and just our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals. There's been a lot of issues in this case, and I just don't want anyone to think that one prosecutor, in this case, at least one prosecutor was involved in this. It's been a team effort in the clearest sense of the word.
Debbie Green said in an interview afterward, even with the trial's end, it will be hard getting over witnessing the death of both officers.
It's never going to be a closure for me, no matter what, because I see it, I relive it in my head, what happened that night. So it'll never be over for me. I'll learn to cope with it. But it'll never go away. You don't forget that something like that.
Green said justice may have been served in court, but she said Marvin still has a higher power, God, to answer to for what he's done. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, suicide used to be common in Cake.
When it started happening, it was just like shell shock. You know, it was just happening one after the other. And it kind of caught everybody off guard.
Now it's rare. We'll have the story of how the community made it happen. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Alaskans voting for president have 4 choices. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, Green Party and Libertarian Party candidates qualified for spots on Alaska's ballot and could siphon popular votes away from the major parties.
Alaska has a history of supporting so-called second-tier candidates. Reform candidate Ross Perot won 28% of the vote in 1992. Gail Finumiai directs the Alaska Division of Elections. She says both Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and Green Party candidate Jill Stein passed state muster to land a spot on the ballot.
We had to gather signatures of registered voters in the state of Alaska equal to 1% of the voters who cast ballots for president at the last presidential election. So they had to submit a petition with at least 3,273 signatures.
That may not sound too difficult. Finumiai says everyone who applied to appear on the ballot was granted a spot. But political scientist Lawrence Jacobs says gathering even a relatively small number of signatures is not easy. Third-party campaigns tend to operate on a dime, which keeps the organization small, and it's incredibly hard to grow a small political organization into something larger.
They don't have teams of lawyers. They don't have money. And to get your name on the ballot, you need to have both the lawyers and the money.
To file the paperwork, to collect the signatures. And Jacobs adds, the rules are stacked against smaller parties.
The rules of the game are written to discourage third parties. Our system, for instance, for Electoral College votes, is not distributed based on number of popular votes cast. It's a winner-take-all system.
Which means the Green and Libertarian parties are unlikely to capture the state's three electoral votes. But they could add the popular vote. And any federal candidate who wins 5% of the popular vote can qualify for federal financing in the following election. That's a message promoted by Gary Johnson in this commercial that's airing in Anchorage.
We've seen how the two-party system has ruined our nation. They've kept us in a state of perpetual war, driven our jobs overseas, bankrupted us, overtaxed, and overspent us. But here's the good news. 5% of the vote in 2012 is all it takes to end the two-party system in America for good. This year, do something revolutionary. Cast a protest vote that counts.
Johnson's Libertarian Party wound up on the ballot through the independent candidate route, meaning the political organization is recognized by the state for this election only. The Division of Elections, Gail Fenoumier, says the Green Party opted for what's known as the limited political party method, which could allow them to stick around for 2014.
It's a political group that organizes for the purpose of selecting candidates for electors for president and vice president. And then they may also then maintain their status of a limited political party if their candidate receives at least 3% of the vote.
And that means, regardless of whether the third parties on the ballot in Alaska play a role nationally, at least one could be around for some time to come. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
Voters will also decide tomorrow whether the state should sell more than $450 million in bonds to pay for transportation and economic development projects. It's one of the largest bond propositions in Alaska history, and one Fairbanks area project on the list does not have support from the local community. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
A proposed road connecting the old Steese Highway with McGrath Road and Fairbanks plows through wetlands along the northern edge of Creamersfield Migratory Waterfowl Refuge. It also crosses historic mushing trails and cuts straight through a popular duck pond. Funding for the preliminary road study comes from the federal government. If voters passed Bond Proposition A, $24 million in state funding would pay for a nearly identical effort. This particular project only accounts for 5% of Prop A. Even so, more than 200 people gathered to hear about it last month.
My name is Christina Moore, and my major concern with this project is I live right there.
My name is Paulette Willie, and I live on Chena Ridge Road. Every time projects affect people who live outside of town, I have a concern.
My name's Gerald Brown. I'm here as a concerned citizen because I don't think this is a good project.
Does this change at all how you plan to vote on the bond package?
Even though I think it's you know, wielding a big stick for one project, at this point I have decided for the first time ever I will probably vote against.
If that's the only way to stop this project, that would be the way I would vote then.
The list of proposed transportation and economic development projects included in the measure is long, and the road through the bird refuge isn't the only proposal that's controversial. The Sitka Assembly rejected a resolution to support a road to Catlin Bay. Two major South Central projects in the proposition have also garnered negative attention. Governor Parnell originally proposed a smaller $350 million bond package, mostly to pay for the Port of Anchorage expansion and an Alaska Railroad extension to Port McKenzie. Legislators chiseled the governor's request down to $80 million. Then they added their own projects to the bill.
Sometimes people say, be careful, this bill is becoming a Christmas tree.
That's Rebecca Braun. She's the editor and publisher of the Alaska Budget Report, which tracks the state's budgeting process. She says bonding propositions are one of the only ways projects in smaller communities get funding.
Everybody is kind of, sees a bill that's moving and they all want to hang their favorite ornaments on it, and sometimes legislators will even say, if we Christmas tree this bill too much, it's going to fall under its own weight.
Republican Representative Steve Thompson is running unopposed this year. He helped add the Creamersfield Refuge Road connector and a local bridge replacement to the package.
I don't think we had any other projects of this magnitude that we could put into that bond package. You know, these were like, okay, if we we want to try to get a couple of things done, then we have to put these two in.
Thompson says in all the years he's been to public meetings, he hasn't seen the community so opposed to a state-funded proposal.
I wish that bill would have been rewritten different had we known that there was this much opposition and also the amount of wetlands.
Since 1960, Alaskans have cast ballots for just six bond propositions larger than this year's. But back then, Alaskans paid state income tax, so bond propositions that passed translated to a direct increase in their taxes. Rebecca Braun says these days a disconnect between legislators and their constituents means funding for unpopular projects can pass more easily.
Legislators tend to be most in touch with what they consider community leaders, you know, in their districts. And that's often, Chamber of Commerce types, builders, people who want projects. They want the economic development. They want the jobs. And sometimes there are big factions of the general public that have other concerns that don't get heard so much.
Of the 94 bonding propositions that have appeared on Alaska's ballot, only seven have failed. Only one of those came with a dollar amount larger than the $453 million in this year's. Nevertheless, Representative Thompson says he doesn't think there's enough statewide opposition for voters to reject it. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
While recent reports show the suicide rate falling slightly within the state, Alaska still has the highest rate in the nation, especially among Alaska Native young men. One community in Southeast had the highest rate in the nation back in the 1980s. But today, suicide is rare in the village. In the next installment of our Being Young in Rural Alaska series from the producers of Kids These Days, Sarah Gonzalez has the story.
We're all tied.
At the Boys and Girls Club in Cake, Alaska, teens gather after school to shoot pool and play video games. Scott Jackson is their mentor, a man in his 30s. He grew up here, and what he lived through as a child led him to his job as a suicide prevention counselor.
Just being here with the epidemic in the 80s when I was a young man, a young little kid, it was a little difficult, you know, losing the family members that I did, which were cousins and uncles and cousin that was like a brother to me. So, you know, in the last couple of years, I really decided that this is the field that I really wanted to partake in.
Residents remember the epidemic as a dark and difficult time in the 80s. 15 young people took their lives in 2 years. Joel Jackson was the local chief of police during the epidemic when he was just 20 years old.
It kind of brought it to light. You know, everybody was going through it. When it started happening, it was just like shell shock. You know, it was just happening one after the other. And it kind of caught everybody off guard, you know. We had some suicides before, but nothing like that. It was all due to alcohol.
The residents recognized the need to cope with this immediately. It's why they decided that talking openly and honestly as a community was the only way to heal. Cake resident Anthony Gastelum is a suicide survivor himself, and he's candid about his past struggles with drugs and alcohol. Today, he's been sober for almost 20 years, and he works in suicide prevention with youth. He knows from experience that successful prevention is more than a one-off class or a pamphlet you hand to kids saying, don't do it. It's learning Tlingit dances, it's a safe place to do homework, and it's helping adults heal from substance abuse and alcoholism.
Being around adults that live a clean and sober life and can learn by example is very attractive to the students that are involved in the things that we do in the community.
Gastelum says if you ask them, most of the kids in Cake probably wouldn't pinpoint suicide as an issue in their village today, and he likes it that way. He's working to help create a physically and mentally healthy environment for them to grow up in.
And you know, it is true that it does take a whole community to raise children.
Community efforts like youth culture camps teach traditional knowledge, instilling a strong sense of self and of place in the residents. And this year, CAKE held its first adult culture camp. Research shows that Indigenous people who live in communities where they are able to participate in traditional activities rate their levels of happiness higher than those who live in communities where they feel detached, doing things like hunting, fishing, and carving.
When you carve, for me anyway, it's like putting my mind at ease.
Former Police Chief Jackson started a carving group for boys and men of all ages. They create duck calls, canoe paddles, but the main goal of the group isn't just making wooden items.
And when you're carving and you're dealing with sharp knives, you basically have to concentrate. You got to have your mind in a good state. So it's just more or less trying to get them to, you know, put their things, whatever's bothering them, aside. And it seems to work.
A proponent for big picture suicide prevention, 36-year-old Yvonne Peter from Fairbanks hosts workshops in rural Alaska, bringing the idea of cultural healing to entire communities.
It's kind of this coupling of raising awareness, healing, and a pursuit of self-determination. And I think when those all meet up and come together, then we're pursuing something that's so positive and so meaningful and valuable to ourselves and to future generations, and it just makes sense.
His work acknowledges how historical traumas like colonization and assimilation led to loss of traditional ways, while institutional abuses like punishment for speaking Indigenous language further exacerbated a deep collective sadness. Peter says self-determination is key to future prevention efforts.
Being able to be in control of a direction of our destiny. I mean, it's what all people want, to be able to self-govern ourselves, to have educational institutions, economic institutions, social government institutions that reflect our values, what it is that we believe in, what's important to us as a people moving forward.
Peter says Alaska Native people are striving for that now in communities across the state. And communities like CAKE prove that a holistic, out-in-the-open, village-wide effort towards wellness will help kids to live better lives. Reporting from CAKE, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
For more information about the series, Being Young in Rural Alaska, and to see pictures from CAKE, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. Women in Wrangell are strapping on roller skates and heading to the rink. KSTK's Ariel Van Cleve has the story.
Wrangell's Garnet Grit Betties meet Wednesday and Sunday evenings at the skating rink inside Hope Community Church. 10 women showed up during a recent practice. They took a few spins around the track, practiced skating fundamentals, and learned some derby techniques.
It's a big difference than, you know, just your everyday activity for sure. I think we're probably all going to have one big leg from going the same way around the track all the time.
That's Shauna Bunis. She's one of the founding members of the Betties. Bunis, along with Mickey Capella and Jennifer Wiederspoon, decided to assemble a team for Wrangell.
None of us know what we're doing. None of us have ever played roller derby. We've seen it, we've watched it, but we've never been any part of it. So that's been a real challenge, is all the research and in contact with other leagues, trying to learn and figure out what we need to do to start.
When playing roller derby, two teams of five players compete in a series of races. The individual races are called jams, and the whole match is known as a bout. Points are scored by players called jammers who take laps around the track while busting their way through the opposing team's blockers. Roller derby is a full contact sport. The use of arms and elbows is strongly encouraged. Bunis says they had their first official practice in the beginning of October. As many as 20 people have shown up to skate, but Bunis admits that so far there have only been a handful of women who are able to consistently take part.
Roller derby is a big commitment. It's a huge commitment. I can't tell you the hours that I have spent dedicated to this in the last 3 weeks. And, you know, a lot of people just aren't quite ready to make that commitment. And we've tried to be good with working into everybody's schedule, but not everybody can be here every night.
The Betties join a small but growing list of derby teams throughout the state. According to akrollerderby.com, there are nearly a dozen active leagues. Two of those are located in Juneau. Buna says a friend of hers is in the Juno Roller Girls League, and she attended one of their bouts in September to get a better feel for what to expect. She says those Derby girls have showered the Bettys with support.
They were so excited. They have so few teams in Southeast Alaska to play that immediately they have just been on the Facebook page, what do you need, what do you need?
April Rebert is president of the Juno Roller Girls, but she prefers to go by April Mayhem.
I was a part of the inception, and I've been addicted and a prisoner and slave to its purpose ever since.
She says she's glad to hear about Wrangell's attempts to form a league and can't wait to skate with them. Mayhem says the best part about roller derby is that all are welcome.
One of the things that I love about the sport is that it's new enough, it's at least in its most recent resurrection, that women who weren't necessarily athletes before or don't have the experience are still very much welcome in the sport.
The Juno Roller Girls League has two home teams, the Killcats and the Raven Lunatics. They also have a traveling team. Mayhem says the league has 45 active skaters and their bouts often sell out.
It's out of control. It's wonderful. And people come from all walks of life. Like, we get sports fanatics in there. We get, like, the football fans. We get punk rock girls who are just kind of in it for the culture, but they also fall in love with the sport. We get kids and families because they want to see, you know, mommy on the track throwing hips.
Mayhem suggests the Bettys work out a mission for their league, start fundraising and volunteering throughout the community. Buna says the Bettys have been volunteering in Wrangell to get their name out. She expects it will take about a year to establish a league. For now, they're looking for more skaters and non-skaters alike to build up a team. Mayhem was even doing a little recruiting on the Bettys' behalf.
So you're not going to skate?
Well, I am so so bad on skates. Like, I should not be on any sort of wheels. In Wrangell, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Matt Miller in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Sarah Gonzalez in Cake, and Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. They own facilities to make improvements to increase energy. Financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.